This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome once again to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 27th episode. Today, we look at an article from the JCENM in the controversial area of androgen therapy in women. We will wrestle not only with whether women with low androgen levels should be supplemented with androgens, but also whether the literature supports the existence of a condition of androgen deficiency in women at all. Fortunately, I've got a great group with me to tackle this complicated and challenging area. As always, we will carefully consider the study design employed here, as that will give us insight into the conclusions drawn by the authors. Briefly, I host Endocrine Feedback Loop, but spend the majority of my time as a general endocrinologist at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, where I direct our endocrine clinics and serve as one of the APDs for our fellowship. Anna Goldman joins me again as our regular contributor today. She is currently in practice in Boston and teaches at Harvard Medical School. She attends at Brigham and Women's Hospital, where she was an APD for their fellowship for several years. She has clinical expertise in reproductive endocrinology, which will come in handy today. Our guest expert today is well known to our listeners. Maggie Wehrman has been at the University of Colorado in Denver for many years, where she has established herself as an international expert in pituitary and adrenal disorders. In particular, she is an expert on androgen therapy in women, having written the guidelines from the Endocrine Society on this very topic. So while the topic is a daunting one, I couldn't have a better pair of endocrinologists to explain it to us. As is always the case, everything we say today will be our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. For this episode of the podcast, we review DHEA on sexual function and Sheehan syndrome, a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled crossover trial. Sumita Mandal served as the primary author for this article that comes to us from the R.G. Carr Medical College and the Institute of Postgraduate Medical Education and Research, both in Kolkata, India. It is a forthcoming paper to be published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. At this point, Anna will walk us through the author's introduction and the points that they make. She and Maggie will also help us understand the larger context here and areas of uncertainty and controversy in this field. Anna?
Sheehan syndrome occurs due to ischemic destruction of the pituitary gland due to massive postpartum hemorrhage. Generally, patients develop panhypopituitarism and require replacement therapy with glucocorticoids, levothyroxine, sex steroids, and occasionally growth hormone. However, the prevalence of sexual dysfunction in one study was reportedly greater than 90%. So we know that sexual dysfunction is complex and multifactorial and could be due to concomitant treatment of depression with SSRIs, or due to profoundly low levels of ovarian and adrenal sex steroids, especially androgens, leading to decreased libido, arousal, and or orgasm. Dehydroepiandrosterone, or DHEA, is a weak adrenal androgen that has been studied in women with low androgen levels from various etiologies. They have not shown a consistent improvement in sexual function, and the Endocrine Society has not recommended DHEA for the treatment of women with low androgen levels because of the lack of adequate data supporting efficacy. Maggie, as the first author on the Endocrine Society Task Force guidelines, would you mind giving us an overview of these guidelines and why androgen therapy was not recommended?
The Endocrine Society has guidelines, and there more recently is an international guideline that was supported by the Endocrine Society, again, led by Sue Davis, that reiterated our suggestions in the latest Endocrine Society guidelines. It looked at both the role of testosterone as a primary androgen or the adrenal prohormone DHEA. It can't bind the androgen receptor itself, but gets converted into testosterone and or estradiol at different target tissues, and looked at the studies in the literature about giving it back. What was its role, giving it back at different doses, and what were the outcomes? And the overall conclusions is that both for primary and secondary adrenal insufficiency, those patients with Addison's disease, where their adrenals are gone, or the patients with hypopituitarism, either isolated ACTH deficiency or panhypopituitarism, there really weren't data that strongly supported the use of replacement for any of the outcomes, from sexual function to well-being to bone and cognitive issues. And so in that data, we recommended against the use of DHEA therapy.
So the authors reported that compared with other forms of isolated secondary adrenal insufficiency, Sheehan syndrome causes a more profound adrenal and ovarian dysfunction leading to low androgen levels due to the loss of ACTH and gonadotropins. Maggie, do you think these differences might prevent a generalization of the study outcomes to women with low androgen levels from other etiologies?
I guess low androgens needs to be defined. As endocrinologists, we love assays and we try to pair them with signs and symptoms. In contrast to men, where using a good testosterone assay, there are signs and symptoms that correlate with androgen deficiency, there aren't any data to support that there's an androgen deficiency syndrome in women, i.e. signs and symptoms that when you change a level of either testosterone or DHEA prohormones, that those symptoms improve. That would be the first point. And then secondly, Sheehan's is extremely rare. And in all developed countries, it's almost reportable. And if you go back to the literature about what causes it, it's unclear if in the original historical literature, these were young women that had pituitary tumors that infarcted during a hypotensive spell, or in the few series that have come from underdeveloped areas, again, related to this postpartum hemorrhage and apoplexy of the pituitary. So they would have, however, the same hormone deficiencies of gonadotropins, of ACTH, of TSH, and of growth hormone than other causes of hypopituitarism. In the guidelines, when we looked at the data, there had been several small studies of using DHEA between 25 and 50 milligrams a day. And some of the studies showed a small effect on well-being. Others showed in a crossover study no effect on well-being or sexual activity or sexual interest. And there was a very nice meta-analysis of 10 studies that looked at both primary adrenal insufficiency and hypopituitarism or secondary ACTH deficiency. And their conclusion was there is no effect of giving DHEA on sexual function. So it's intriguing that this study, which their original observations were published in Endocrine Practice, describing this very high rate in their collection of women with Sheehan syndrome of sexual dysfunction, is a little out of step with what the literature has shown in other studies.
So the goal of this randomized double-blind crossover trial was to determine the efficacy of DHEA supplementation in Sheehan syndrome. So Chase, on to you for discussion of the methods.
Great. Thanks, Maggie. And you guys have set things up really nicely here of wanting to look at this and understand what these findings are and what they mean, recognizing that this is it's an area to where we're going to push into some boundaries that we haven't encountered before, say potentially recommending some therapy that's not the standard of care now. So obviously wanting to think about this really carefully, make sure we understand how the study was done, any potential limitations that are going to come along with it. So that's going to help us then evaluate the conclusions that the author draw. And as we always end our podcast episodes, trying to decide, does this need to change our practice or do we need to be hesitant, look for other data, wait before we make any changes for now? So that's where we're going with this and where we want to think about all these things really carefully. And as necessarily the case, we need to stop at the methods and really understand what study design is being used here. That helps us understand what the limitations of this are, what the situations that we can apply these results to, if anything. So first of all, we're going to think about, as we always do, is the overall type of study design, the inferential method that's employed here. As Anna just mentioned, these authors use a crossover RCT. So as a reminder of a randomized control trial, how a normal, not a crossover, but a normal RCT works is you have at least two groups and sometimes multiple groups, but in a typical standard RCT, you have a couple of groups, one that is treated and one group that is not treated and ideally has a placebo. And what makes it a randomized trial is that whether a subject gets into the treated group or the placebo group is randomized. So there's no intentional selection or putting a subject into one group or the other. Crossover RCTs are a little bit different in that at one point in time, everybody in the study is going to be either in the treated group or in the placebo group. And that happens because you do a period of time to where you are receiving the treatment that's under investigation. And then at a different point of time during the study, you are receiving the placebo. What makes it randomized here is that the order that you go through that is different. So some of the individuals will first get placebo, and then later on in the study, they'll get the study drug that's under investigation, and then the other group will be opposite. They will start with the study drug under investigation and then later receive the placebo. So that's how these crossover RCTs work. So now let's look at how these authors use that. So they describe their study as a single center, double blind, placebo controlled crossover RCT. And the way this study was set up for the inclusion criteria, you had to be 18 years of age or older with documented Sheehan syndrome, having female sexual dysfunction, or as the authors abbreviate that, FSD, diagnosed with the female sexual function index. That's the FSFI. So a couple of abbreviations to keep track of. And the authors describe this as a validated questionnaire for objective documentation of female sexual dysfunction. The scores on the FSFI range from 2 up to 36, and the cutoff that they used for female sexual dysfunction was 26.55 or lower. So, Maggie, I think we need your help here again to understand this a little bit more. I would say this is not a questionnaire that I'm familiar with at all. So if you can help us understand, is this something that's used really only in research context, or does it have potential clinical applicability, or how do we need to be thinking about these results as we get to those later on in this discussion?
That's a somewhat complicated issue. So the whole issue of female sexual dysfunction has changed over the years. And these questionnaires, such as the FSFI, were developed with a whole series of questions. This is the long one of 16 parts. There's a shorter one that can be used clinically. This is used for research studies. But the big issue historically in the data of the incidence of female sexual dysfunction were the fact that in the initial studies, up to 70% of women across their life had sexual dysfunction. It was extremely high. And it didn't change across menopause. It was just as common if you were premenopausal and postmenopausal. And then with reevaluation of these questionnaires, it was apparent that the issue of causing distress, I mean, did it make any difference to the woman if those things were abnormal or not, was not included in these questionnaires. So a second set of questionnaires, and the one that's been used the most, is called the FSDSR, which asks about distress. So you may not have sexual thoughts every day, but does that bother you? And especially as we look at the menopausal versus premenopausal cohort, that's important to recognize. The other point, the FSFI is used in many studies, and for new drugs, it's sometimes used with an additional question about distress, because that's how they recruit their subjects, is the fact that it's been recently called into question as not being relevant across age. For example, there's a huge number of what they call Miss Flash studies, and a recent paper published in Menopause that sort of looked at what are the criteria for sexual dysfunction in women in the postmenopausal age. And they concluded, using both of these two different questionnaires, that you really should go to 21. So 21 is normal instead of 26 in the postmenopausal group. So here you have an argument in the literature about what is really abnormal. So I think the take-home point is this is a questionnaire that's used. It has a major defect in that it doesn't assess distress, and is that really female sexual dysfunction, which these other questionnaires do, and the fact that it's being reevaluated across different ethnicities and different regions of the world on what is really abnormal. So those caveats to consider.
So this topic wasn't complicated and confusing enough. So we've already got an extra wrinkle there that we'll have to keep track of as we go along. But that was extremely helpful. Thank you. So a few more things that the authors point out. So to go back to the diagnostic criteria for Sheehan syndrome, I think this is going to be helpful to review for the reason that Maggie pointed out. This is not a common issue currently, fortunately, and particularly in the United States. So we'll go through the details of how the authors define that. So to meet that inclusion criteria, you had to have failure of postpartum lactation and or failure to resume menses following severe postpartum hemorrhage with severe hypotension and shock and hypopituitarism, which was diagnosed by the deficiency of one or more pituitary hormones, along with documentation of imaging of empty cell syndrome. As far as exclusion criteria go, that patients who were on an SSRI were excluded from this study. And there were 28 subjects who were enrolled in this study. They had to be sexually active and yet have FSD to be included in this. And I'll just comment that we're talking about as a very specific group that we have here, and that enrolling only those who were both sexually active and had FSD does limit this a little bit. So we need to think about if we're going to be applying these results to anybody, the very specific population that was studied here. The primary objective, as described by the authors, is to find any improvement in that FSFI score in patients receiving DHEA versus placebo after 3 months. Another comment that I would add here, I would caveat that a little bit. If you look at the statistical methodology at the power calculation that the authors do, they define what a meaningful difference is. That's actually a necessary step in doing a power calculation. And they define that as a difference of 2 points on that FSFI. So that's actually, even though they describe it as looking for any improvement, really the way it's designed is they wanted to see at least a 2-point improvement. And that's how they set that study up. The authors point out that all of the subjects who were involved in this investigation were receiving regular therapy with glucocorticoids and levothyroxine. None of them, however, were on growth hormone, and they point that out that was because of financial constraints. And also, only 21 of the 28 were on estrogen replacement. The remaining 7 were not due to patient preference. The authors
Can I make a comment?
Yes, please do, that? Maggie.
What's not clear that they don't tell us is what type of birth control pill, and that if you look at the criteria, these were pre and postmenopausal women, but their average age was in their 40s. So this is not an early postpartum process, but a delayed, a cohort they've been following for a period of time. And I think that makes a difference. But not having the power to subdivide pre and postmenopausal and on and off estrogen becomes another confounding factor in the analysis of the data. I couldn't find, and maybe you all found, the free T4 levels for our assay seemed extremely low. And the guidelines for the Endocrine Society for hypopit suggest that free T4 levels should be targeted to the top third of the normal range. I couldn't find that. In our assay, at least the numbers that they quoted would be not at that goal.
Agreed.
A few more comments that the authors make. One is about the patient allocation or how they assign them. So they use a block randomization technique to make blocks of 4 patients, so 7 total patients there. And in each of those blocks, the patients were divided into 2 groups to receive either DHEA 25 milligrams twice daily or placebo for a total of 12 weeks. So each of those groups had 14 patients. And then there was a washout period in between those as a standard in crossover RCTs when that can be done. And that was 4 weeks. So a few more questions for Maggie here. So curious with that supplementation you mentioned in some of the previous studies that a dose like this was used, about 25 milligrams twice a day of DHEA. So any comments about selecting that dose and why whenever we're treating these individuals that we are using DHEA as opposed to some other androgen like just testosterone replacement?
So DHEA is available over the counter in the U.S. and it's available in the internet globally. It's not available in all countries, and I don't know about India. In the studies that have been used of DHEA administration for many different causes, but for primary and secondary adrenal insufficiency, in women, the physiologic dose is about 25 milligrams. So it's interesting that they decided to give 25 twice a day. DHEA, you know, normally is pulsatile, and so it has a shorter action than DHEAS. DHEAS is not available to take. And so it may be that they decided to split up the dose to try to keep an even level.
It's just a few other comments in before we wrap up the methods section. So throughout the study, periodically, labs were measured and also this FSFI questionnaire was administered to the subjects. And so we'll get Maggie's input here again. So when we think about measuring lab. So how are different labs helpful here? So what is DHEAS helpful when we're assessing whether somebody is adequately dosed for DHEA? And would it have been helpful to measure other androgens such as, again, testosterone levels here?
So it's standard in the prior studies that were done with DHEA because of the short half-life to measure its sulfated product, DHEAS, because it's converted into that. It can be converted, however, into testosterone or estradiol. We did a study years ago where we gave DHEA and looked at effects on cognition. And over the period of the 4 hours after a dose, you could see changes in testosterone first and then in estradiol. But you'd have to do very detailed studies to look at that. And that was not done.
And before we move on to the results, I'll open up for comments for both Maggie and Anna. Any other comments about the study design here, any strengths or weaknesses in particular that we haven't commented or discussed already that would be helpful for us to point out before we move on?
The only question is the time of the washout is 4 weeks. If they were giving the effective dose of 50 milligrams a day and it's pharmacologic, it might take more than 4 weeks to wash out of their system. Whereas if they're in the mid-physiologic for postmenopausal versus premenopausal, it should have gotten washed out.
Excellent. We'll revisit that. The authors do make some comments on that in their discussion as well as their measurements of different hormones along the way. So we'll come back to both of those issues when we get to the discussion here at the end. But first, Anne, I'm going to turn it back over to you to walk us through the results and then what the authors found with this investigation.
So the average age was around 39 in both groups, and the average BMI was also in the normal range. The median interval between the inciting event to the diagnosis of Sheehan syndrome was 8.2 years, which I was very surprised by. That seems very long. All of the participants had sexual dysfunction and a serum DHEAS, which was below the detection limit, so less than 15 micrograms per deciliter. 10 subjects in the DHEA first group and 11 subjects in the placebo first group were receiving gonadal replacement, and the groups were overall well-balanced. So comparison of the FSFI between DHEA and placebo for all included patients revealed that those who had received DHEA had an improvement in the FSFI score at the end of the study to 30.3 from a baseline of 22.7. And the increment of FSFI change in the DHEA group was statistically significant as compared to placebo with a p-score of 0.006. So while this was a statistically significant change, do we think this was a clinically significant change? I'll pose that to Chase and Maggie.
Well, I'd say that is a pretty dramatic change in the FSFI and sort of hard to believe in 12 weeks. However, you notice that the placebo group improved into the quote normal FSFI. And so they discussed whether it's crossover effect, but it suggests a strong placebo effect of participating in the study. In other interventions or new drugs that are coming out, this is a more dramatic bump in an FSFI than one would expect. And the question is it a mixed effect related to the different types of patients they had, whether they were on estrogens or not, whether any of the DHEA was converted into estrogens, things like that. Those are the kind of questions I'd be asking.
And one might surmise that it was more of a response than the authors were anticipating. Usually the power calculation is based on either previous research that those authors themselves have done or from a review of the literature. And so they estimated about an impact of 2. One would guess that's why they chose that. And so this was an increase of 4 here. So you could guess that maybe it was about twice as effective as even they were anticipating based on their power calculation.
So in the patients in group A who received placebo, then DHEA, the FSI rose from 23 to 26.3 with a p-score of 0.064 at the end of the first phase. But after receiving DHEA, their total FSFI rose to 30.4. And that was statistically significant with a p-score of 0.001. None of the individual parameters of the FSFI improved after the first phase, except the domain of satisfaction. And after DHEA, this domain did not improve further, but the domains of desire, arousal, lubrication, and orgasm all had statistically significant improvements. Does anybody have any further comments on the impressive placebo effect?
The only thing I was going to add was perhaps a bit of an analogy is that that was also clearly seen in male hypogonadism, particularly in the T trials, is as they all demonstrated, and I probably will be overstating this, but perhaps the most important thing about being on testosterone is thinking that you're on testosterone, whether you're on it or not, as far as seeing the effects on sexual function. And so it makes me wonder if there is something similar functioning here, as Maggie pointed out earlier.
So the patients in group B who received DHEA followed by placebo showed remarkable improvement in the total FSFI from 22 to 30.3 after receiving DHEA. And then after receiving placebo following the active therapy with, of course, the washout, there was a statistical decline in the total median FSFI score. However, interestingly, the total median FSFI score and most parameters remained numerically better than baseline, i.e. before the first phase of the study. And something else that I was curious about when reading this was, were there hyperandrogenizing effects? And so self-reported mild acne and mild hirsutism were seen in 3 and 2 patients respectively, and no other androgenic effects were noted with DHEA therapy.
Thanks, Anna. So now we're going to move into the discussion. And as we typically do, we're going to walk through the conclusions that the authors draw from their work and some of the other key points that they make along the way. And then we'll give you some of our thoughts and questions that we have that may not have been fully answered based on this investigation. So first of all, to give you the authors' summary of their investigation, they say that in this study, patients with Sheehan syndrome having sexual dysfunction had a significant improvement after replacement with DHEA, 25 milligrams twice a day, indicated by an improvement of the total FSFI score as well as in individual domain scores, including sexual desire, arousal, lubrication, orgasm, and satisfaction, and that the serum concentration of DHEAS increased into the normal range with that. And as is typically the case with these studies, the authors do a literature review. Maggie pointed out many of these already as she reviewed what went into the guidelines that are out there, and then the authors point out some of these as well. And they do mention that there are discrepant findings in the literature, though they didn't really go into much of an explanation to try to explain. And it's not an easy thing to explain, and we may not have a good understanding of that. But I was curious about that. We have different studies. Some of these studies seem to suggest that maybe there's some benefit in taking androgen therapy for women with low levels, and many other studies that suggest that there isn't a benefit, or at least one, not one that we have been able to measure. And so I was curious as to any possible theories or ideas that could explain these discrepant findings. So I'll ask Anna and Maggie here, any ideas that you all have about why this may be different, why some studies are finding positive benefits, but many others don't seem to be identifying one.
I'll defer to Maggie, who has a better knowledge of the data.
Well, I think many of the studies are small. And so is there selection bias in getting into these studies? These are selected subjects in these studies. And secondly, when you have small studies with different doses of DHEA at different ages, pre and postmenopausal, and on or off estrogens, those are all things that could have different effects. I think it is fairly strong evidence that the latest meta-analysis of all the studies of literature out there did not show a statistically significant improvement in sexual function when given DHEA. And that's including both the higher doses and the lower doses. And so I think whenever you see a small study that is interesting and suggestive, again, first of all, Sheehan's is extremely rare. So if you say, okay, well, I'm not seeing a Sheehan's patient, I'm seeing somebody who's hypo-pit, the other hypo-pit literature does not support this kind of dramatic improvement in sexual function when given similar doses of DHEA. It's very unclear how select this population is. It's a cohort they have been following for a while because they have the initial description of these patients. It's fascinating that diagnosis of Sheehan's was made late, 8 years average, but that's common in the other papers that I could find about underdeveloped areas of the world where they find Sheehan's later. In all of our data about hypo-pit, we know the complications long-term of hypo-pit were significant in prior generations and are decreasing as far as life expectancy, complications, et cetera, metabolic and cardiovascular. And is it related to one hormone not being appropriately given back? Either too much glucocorticoids, not enough sex steroids, not enough thyroid hormone. And so whether that plays into a role in this population or in the other populations when they're optimized appropriately, is that we're not given much data about how they're optimized, what the doses of glucocorticoids or thyroid hormone or sex hormones were.
Maggie's made a wonderful point about the applicability of findings in RCTs, and we have to understand exactly what patient population is being studied and be very careful when we attempt to apply that finding to any other population and try to understand what might be translatable to other patient groups and what might not be. So we're going to come back to that at the very end, but glad that she highlighted that in this area already. Okay, so a few other comments and some findings that the authors mentioned. So they point out, as we've discussed already, that after stopping the DHEA, not all the parameters of the SFSFI declined, that potentially explained by that washout period not being long enough, or possibly that there are some long lasting genomic effects of androgen therapy. The authors point out, as Anna did in the introduction, that sexual function is multifactorial, and they also suggest that it may have a permissive effect, as they describe it. And additionally, they say that DHEA assays are not universally available, and it was one of the reasons that they utilized DHEAS here. Some limitations that the authors point out. So they do mention that this is based on subjective improvements. They point out that the lack of growth hormone treatment may have contributed to the low baseline quality of life score that they identified. They mentioned that the study is relatively short, so it's only 3 months that it lasted, and as again has been pointed out, and we've discussed that that washout period of 4 weeks may have been too short for the effect of that relatively high DHEA therapy to have abated. So their summary, first of all, a conclusion that the authors state is that in women with, quote, absolute androgen deficiency, end quote, from Sheehan syndrome and sexual dysfunction, DHEA supplementation improves sexual function without significant side effects. And at the end, they also mention a hypothesis is that possibly intermittent DHEA might also be effective with even fewer side effects than the already few side effects that we're seeing. So where I want us to end our discussion today is thinking about this. And in a second, we're going to come to should this change our practice. But just first of all, comments on this report overall. Anna, we'll start with you. Just what was your impression about this and then the data as presented by the author?
At first glance, it looks like it worked really well and that these patients had a marked improvement in their FSFI scores. But I totally agree with Maggie that there are a lot of potential confounders. And I'm very glad that we picked this paper to discuss because I do have some concerns that make me less likely to use DHEA supplementation. I'm not sure that we can extrapolate those results to other patients with a hypopit.
And we'll think about that more shortly. But Maggie, first of all, for you, just thoughts on the quality of the report overall.
It looks like the design was appropriate. Again, they had reported in a prior publication this cohort of patients with Sheehan's that they've been following for a period of time. It's fascinating to me that all were willing to come into this study who were sexually active. So again, it shows you that they're not going out and finding new patients from a different cohort. Their report of such high levels of sexual dysfunction is intriguing. And those are the kind of questions I ask when I read a report, whether it's in JCNM or in the New England Journal, is did someone miss something? Is there anything different about this cohort of patients that wouldn't be like the patients that I would see or that might have a different response rate? I think as we've mentioned, there's lots of issues in this group of patients pre and postmenopausal, whether their hormone therapy was optimized, whether they're on estrogen or not. The effect size on their FSFI is amazing and higher than one sees with a lot of the other interventions, such as testosterone. Whereas in the testosterone trials, the impact in a subgroup of women with female sexual dysfunction, with hypoactive sexual desire disorder. And again, they don't even discuss the different types of female sexual dysfunction. The impact on FSFI is 2 to 3 points with high dose testosterone getting levels up. So lots of questions, and I don't think as many clear answers and as dogmatic of answers as the authors would have us think.
So we've already sort of transitioning into thinking about, should this change our practice? Or I would say another way of asking this, if this is not going to change our practice, what else do we need to see, knowing that this is not a terribly common group, at least in these substantial degree of hypopituitarism? These studies are small. So what else are we going to need to see, and how likely is it that we're going to get that data to help us answer this? So first of all, so we mentioned several different things that I want us to put together, and I'm going to pose this question to Anna, thinking about how we put together these findings, because there are several complicated things. Anna's pointed out that sexual function is complex, and so that makes it challenging to think about this as we're thinking about just one piece of sexual function. Another one here that was pointed out, that Maggie pointed out already, is that the androgen supplementation, it's unclear if this was simply replacing a physiologic deficit, or if it was actually a dose that was higher than that and more in the pharmacologic range. So there's another challenge to thinking about that with this study. And then also in the larger context, as Maggie's pointed out already, is that it's not really clear if there is such a thing as androgen deficiency as far as a syndrome goes, and how we should think about that. So Anna, how do you, in your mind, put all these things together as far as thinking of, should this change my practice, or no, I need more information before I can really start doing something different than what I'm doing right now?
I think, you know, Sheehan syndrome is incredibly rare. I'm not sure if I have any patients with Sheehan in my own practice, but I personally have not prescribed testosterone or DHEA per my own patients, but that's not to discount that it's a real issue. Patients come in who truly do have sexual dysfunction and are desperate for something, anything that can help them. And so, you know, when I read a paper like this, I'm like, oh, this, you know, this looks promising for this very specific subset of patients. Typically, I refer patients to ASECT. I'm not sure if either of you do the same. That's the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, which I found very helpful. But I'd be curious if either of you have used Plibansaron and Ilesi for patients who have hypoactive sexual desire disorder, HSDD.
Yeah, and actually, maybe I'll pose that to Maggie, and as she thinks about how this might change practice. So help us understand that. So if you've got a woman who, whether you know she has low androgen levels or possibly suspect that she might because of the clinical context, and is suffering from hypoactive sexual desire disorder, meaning that it's bothersome, how do you think about something like androgen supplementation when there are other medication options that are out there? So how do you weigh those two things in your head when you're trying to make a decision? And then I would say incorporate this data into trying to answer that as to whether it would change your practice as is.
So I think about female sexual dysfunction as a circle. And there's a famous paper by Rosemary Besson that talks about the different stages of arousal and orgasm in women and how much more complicated it is than the male. And the impact, and our guidelines point out that testosterone levels, even in the T trials, did not correlate with response. So the level of testosterone or the level of DHEA does not correlate with female sexual dysfunction. Female sexual dysfunction happens in premenopausal women who are having regular periods. It happens in the perimenopause, and it happens in postmenopausal. There are different components to sexual dysfunction related to partner issues, related to vaginal dryness, related to psychosocial issues with stress in the marriage, with mood issues, with many other issues that have to be approached. In my big picture, I'm trying to be a detective and figure out all those. As far as an endocrinologist, I know that women who are estrogen deficient have poor sexual function. So one issue is, can I optimize the estrogen status? And will that make a difference? And then in a hypopit patient, am I optimizing all the other hormone status? But I think one of the big take homes from this is endocrinology is not the cure for female sexual dysfunction. It's much more complicated. And sending somebody to a therapist or a group that works with sexual dysfunction, and this female hypoactive sexual desire disorder is only one subset of female sexual dysfunction. And that's also important, because if you have aversion, or if you have pain related or emotional trauma from prior experiences, that has to be approached very differently. So I think as endocrinologists, we're looking to give back hormones. And the issue is, giving back hormones may not be the answer. And lastly, I would just point out side effects. In the DHEA trials of different doses, when you go past that 3 months, you start seeing male pattern balding, acne, hirsutism. And in older population, you'd be worrying about conversion to T and to E, breast cancer, cardiovascular risk, changes in the lipids. So whenever we're trying to help somebody, we have to think about, you know, how can we help them? How can we know more about what the picture is, but not hurt them too? And those would be the kind of thoughts I would have as I see an individual patient. As far as the other two new drugs that are being FDA approved, they haven't gained much traction because of side effects, because of cost. I think we're looking for an understanding of desire and other aspects of female sexual dysfunction to impact on it, but I don't think we're there yet.
And with that, I would like to thank Anna Goldman and Maggie Weirman for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all learned as much as I did and look forward to you all joining us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of the Endocrine Society with production oversight by Andrea Quillis Sanchez.